by NASA to use their Cygnus as one of the living quarters on the Gateway space station. So I kind of leave Bigelow out, but I'm not gonna count him out. He's been at this for 10, 20, 30 years. I mean, he thought about this 30 years ago. Bigelow is the guy that ran all these, he owns all these motels across the country. I think Motel 8. And now with his money, he's building modules for human spaceflight. And his headquarters is out right near Las Vegas. Good place for a big gamble like that. Let me drop it. This is WS2M. Okay, now last week we were talking about the Ariane 5 eventually being phased out and Ariane 6 being taken over. And the qualification of and the quality of the Ariane flights, they've had like 80 flights now. And I was saying that they were all successful. It turns out they had one failure. I know Dick asked about this. He says, you know, they've never had a failure. And at the time, last week, I said no, but they did have this one failure when they tried to upgrade it back in 2002. It was flying for a while, and they said, well, let's put a different style liquid engine in the vehicle, and apparently that did not go off right. So whatever satellite they had in that time, I think it was for the Middle East, they did lose that. So there was one. I want to acknowledge that. But they fixed that, and don't have to worry about it anymore. They're very reliable. And the reason we were talking about its reliability is within a year or so, actually, it's the beginning of 2021 now, they'll be launching the James Webb Space Telescope, $10 billion American telescope that we put together. It should have been in orbit by 2017, and it's going to be a little late, like, you know, 4 years late. Let me drop it. I was talking about Cygnus before they launch out of Wallops Island in Virginia, not too far from here. In fact, when the Antares rocket that launches Cygnus goes up, you know, if you go out down near the shore, you can see this thing rise above the shore before it goes into orbit around 15 degrees above the horizon. You can see the launches. There's other launches that are now occurring on a regular basis, and will be a lot more in Wallops Island. But they won't be bright enough, I don't think, to see. And just last week, they launched another suborbital flight by the Rock On group. Rock On is, you know, for the last 9 years, NASA gets colleges together and different organizations that are building these CubeSats, and they put them on the suborbital rocket, and it's a carrier rocket, they call it, and they basically a solid booster rocket, around 30 inches in diameter, and they launch these things into space. They go up, you know, 100 miles or so, maybe higher, and they come down with parachutes, and you have dozens of different experiments on board from different locations around the country and around the world. And they call it Rock On. Mike from Connecticut, I forgot his call, Mike number two, that was involved with Rock On in the past. I don't know if he was involved with this one. But they're called sounding rockets. So this one went up successfully. The students all show up at Wallops Island, and they watch these things go. This one got 96 miles up into the air. And apparently all the satellites made it back. And they fish them out of the sea and bring them back, and they're able to do it. I mean, there's a list of colleges, you know, the University of Kentucky, Lexington, University of Maryland, College Park, University of Nebraska, Lincoln, Hobart, you know, the list goes on and on. Geneva, New York, and all these places have experiments on board one particular launch. They do this roughly once a year. So it's pretty much funded by NASA, I believe. They call it Rock On. And a lot of young people get involved with that. So that's the deal with that. European Space Agency, we've been talking about them a lot lately. They are trying to also put a rover on Mars, like we are. We have the 2020 rover that's being constructed. That will be going up next year. That will be launched on an Atlas V rocket from Cape Canaveral, you know, Launch Complex 41. And, you know, we're not the only ones that want to go to Mars. European Space Agency has a rover they've been building for years now. And that's going to be launched in 2020 as well. A little bit after us. But the one that we sent to Mars is going to be nuclear powered. It's got the RTG, the radioisotope thermoelectric generator on board, to power it for years on end. This is solar power, the panels on the air, on the top of it. Very similar to what we did last time with Spirit and Opportunity. And difference in size, though. You know, the Curiosity is big. You know, it's like a, maybe a small SUV car, where the Spirit and Opportunity was about the size of a golf cart. European Space Agency, their vehicle is about the size of, it's somewhere in between, let me put it that way. It's easiest to describe it that way. And it's called the Franklin, named after a scientist, Franklin Roslin, the guy that was involved with the discovery of DNA years ago. And, that was their choice of name. When they went ahead with this, I got the name actually backwards. It's Rosalind Franklin. It's the name of the fellow that they named it after. They have a lander being built by Russia called the Kazakhchuk, the land. That's their name for the lander. So it's a deal between European Space Agency and Russia. Space Agency is building the Rosalind Franklin, and Russia's building the lander itself. That, you know, the problem is they have parachute problems with this thing. Last May, they tried it out. They sent the duplicate of what this rover would be and the weight and everything, and they put it onto a high altitude balloon, sent it up, you know, 10, 15 miles, dropped it, and it's got a series of parachutes. It's not like one parachute opens up. This thing is coming in like, you know, faster than the speed of sound. Like, originally it starts over 13,000 miles an hour. It's got a heat shield. The heat shield separates. But eventually you get to the point where, you know, you're going 13, 1400 miles an hour. So they have a series of four different chutes that open up. They have a drone chute that comes out. That pulls out a little bit bigger chute. Another one pulls out another chute around 30 meters in diameter. And then another one pulls out another one, I think around 45 meters in diameter. It's the biggest chute ever for Mars, over 100 feet in diameter. And back in May, it didn't work out. I think both chutes ripped or tore. They had trouble getting it out of the... they dropped the test piece, you know, the doors that pop open, and these chutes that pop out, they said they had problems with that. And now, just a week or two ago, they tested it again. They made some changes, and sure enough, the main parachute did tear on them. And now they're trying to rush to try to put this all together. They have a certain window that has to be met next year when they launch the rover to Mars. Okay, I found the diameter here. I wrote it down. 114 feet. 114 feet diameter. So, you know, it kind of looks like a rover. It's got six wheels, and you know, it's got the camera, and you know, the telescopic stand that comes out of the top. And it's got biochemistry labs on board looking for life. And who knows, maybe within a year, let's see, maybe a year and a half or so, we'll have a total of three rovers operating back on Mars, which would be really interesting between us and, you know, with Curiosity, the new rover, 2020 rover, and now this one by the European Space Agency. And I think China's trying to jump on this bandwagon as well, but not sure how they're doing. And this all was funded years ago with the two satellites that did make it to Russia, made it to Mars last 2 years ago. And, but it was launched by Russia again, by a Russia Proton rocket. And that's what this one's going to be launched by, a Russian Proton rocket. But the lander, or they had an orbiter and land the last time. The orbiter is still doing good in orbit around Mars, called TRACE. It's got all kinds of instruments detecting the atmosphere and this and that. And then the lander itself, the Schiaparelli, and that was supposed to make it down to the surface. And they were going to test it. They were going to have it battery powered. And they just wanted to see if they were able to land something. They've never done it before. But it didn't work out. It wound up crashing into the surface. So if they succeed with this rover, it will be a first for them if they get Rosalind Franklin successfully on the Mars surface. Let me drop it for any questions or comments. This is WS2N. Okay, another story I've been following is Robonaut 2. Robonaut 2 was sent up to the space station back in 2011. One of the last small payloads. Had a lot of payloads on the final flights that went up to the space station by the shuttle years ago. And one of the things they brought up was this Robonaut 2. Robonaut 2 looks like, you know, it's got a body, two arms, and a head. The computer processing is not officially in the head, it's in the torso, but kind of looks like a body. It's got the hands and everything. And everything was fine. They had it on board. They were testing, the astronauts at the time were testing it, and it was doing good. It could either be operated by the astronauts or maybe even by mission control back in Houston. So they got pretty confident with it. The problem is it was just a torso and two arms and a head. It didn't have any legs. In the long run, they plan on taking this thing, and the legs have like rippers on it. And the goal was eventually not only to have this thing working around the space station, but going outside the space station and attaching itself to the space station and doing work that EVA spacewalk people normally do. So they said, well, let's send up the torso. This is all built by GM, by the way. General Motors had the contract for Robonaut 2. And they sent up the torso. And astronauts, once they got it, they pulled it out of the Dragon. And, you know, by the time it went up, the shuttle had stopped flying. The Dragon was commissioned to bring up the bottom part of Robonaut 2. And they attached it, and they started working on it. And things would stop working. The processor kept failing. Try this, try that. And mission control was telling them, oh, okay, open it up. They're practically doing surgery on this robot, trying to get them to go. And no matter what they did, it kept failing. They kept blowing processes, replacing pieces with things that they had on board, trying to get it to work. So finally, after giving up, they couldn't get anything done. One of the Dragon spacecraft that went up to or docked with the space station took Romanoff to a back, and that was like, I don't know, a year and a half ago. Took a back, it landed in the Pacific Ocean. You know, Dragon doesn't burn up. It's designed to bring back science experiments and spacesuits, in this case, Romanoff 2. And they took this thing back to headquarters and gave it back to all the engineers to try to work on it. I know Dick always talks about, the electronics, how important it is to make sure your grounds are connected. You don't want electricity going through another part of your system and using that as a way to get back to your power source. You could fry things. You need a good ground loop system. You know, that green wire has to be hooked up somewhere. Otherwise, for everything that's on board, you operate something, and next thing you know, if you don't have a good ground system going through a chassis ground, it's going to find another path. And in this case, it was going through processors and memory chips and just burning things out left and right. It's a good lesson to learn on these multi-million-dollar robots. Make sure your ground connections or chassis connections, in this case, are very secure and there. In this case, they were missing. So they figured out what's wrong with it. They got it all working now. And I think November, or one of those flights, they'll be flying it up. I don't know if it's going to go up on a Cygnus spacecraft or a SpaceX Dragon spacecraft yet, but they plan on bringing it back up and seeing if they can get it going. Once they do, it'll be joined by another robot. The Russians plan on bringing one up too. But this thing will work with the other Astrobees that are also flying around presently on the space station. Astrobees are these cubes. Free-flying cubes. They have fans on them, and they could do work. They could look through the space station for things that are missing. They don't have to worry about legs or anything because these astrobees have fans, and they have different vanes that open up and close. And depending how the air is blowing through these things, it will allow the astrobees to, get up and fly from one end of the space station to the other if they want. And there's three of these things, and they're autonomous, and they, when they start to run out of power, they know to go all the way back to the charging wall. Astrobee has these chargers mounted on the wall, and I think they have it in Columbia. Pretty sure that's where the charging units are. But it flies back and attaches, and it recharges itself, and then it's good to go again. And actually, they have two on board right now. The third one is going to be sent up not too far from now, but they do have two up there now. And this robot, Robonaut 2, will actually be able to work in conjunction with these things. Astrobee 2 would never be able to go outside the space station, the two Astrobees, because they work on pushing air around them. There's no air outside. But Robonaut 2 could. I think it's going to be a long time before you actually see an EVA done by this thing. But, that is a long-term goal for robot technology on board the space station. Any comments or questions so far before I do the next topic, which I think is really interesting?
Sure.
Station, go ahead. All right, I heard somebody key up. I think I gave it enough time for anybody coming through on Echo Link. But I don't know. This next topic has to do with the company Rocket Lab. Again, another popular topic I've talked about here before. Rocket Lab is another American company owned by Peter Beck, another one of these like billionaire guys, and he's been building the Electron rocket successfully. It's a black carbon structure. It's not stainless steel or anything. A lot of the engines are 3D manufactured. They do fly with 9 engines on a booster, similar to SpaceX. And when they separate from the when the second stage separates from the booster, the second stage also has a one engine, very similar to SpaceX. The difference is they call them the Electron rockets. And the reason for that is the these rockets, for each engine, has its own turbo pump, and the turbo pump is a tremendous amount of fuel. In this case, RP-1 rocket propellant number one, which is really kerosene and liquid oxygen into the tanks. Normally, it's driven by another source, an exhaust type of another exhaust from your standard engines that are firing. They have pre-burn is doing that work. But this, he has none of that. No piping, no plumbing. He just has 50 horsepower motors being driven by lithium-ion batteries, creating enough pressure to successfully, so far, use it on these engines. And he's had like 8 orbital flights so far over the last couple of years. He's increasing that cadence little by little. And he's getting to the point where he's manufacturing rocket engines not fast enough for the manifest of flights that he needs to put out to space. So to keep up, he's thinking, well, let's go and use reusability. Now, he crossed off reusability, years ago. Now we're not going to do that. We're just going to mass produce these rockets and shoot them up one after the other. He's finding that a little difficult to do, to keep up with. He needs to be able to fly, he states like over 40 flights a year. He'd like to get to like a flight per week if he could, but 40 flights per year for all these different people that want him to fly. The first question they ask him, he says, is when can I fly? Not how much does it cost? And it's pretty good. It's $5.6 million. It's roughly 1/10 of what you would pay on a Elon Musk Falcon 9 flight. They're around $62 million per flight. You could for $62 million you could get a whole Falcon 9 and put it up into orbit, put anything you want up in there. Of course, then you'd have to pay for the satellite, whatever you're doing, and that might be $500 million or something. But to launch is $62 million. This guy Peter Beck with these Electron rockets is only $5.8 million. I think $5.6 million. So that's not bad. But his goal is to create reusability. He needs to have these things come back. He's not developing a system like Elon Musk where he'll take like 30% of the fuel and save it, and that will be enough fuel to bring him back and land on a barge or bring it back to land. Peter Beck is interested in doing that with the Electron rocket. What he wants to do is, have it go up, put its payload into orbit, like he's been doing. He's got like 8 successful flights. The booster would separate from the second stage, and then the booster would start coming back into the atmosphere, again, tail down, similar to what Elon Musk does. The only difference is he plans on using parachutes. So once he can get from, his, 8G, gravitational pull on the vehicle down to, 1G, into the atmosphere, once he could slow it down enough, he's thinking about using different systems of doing that. But for now, he wants to be able to get it through the atmosphere. He's got this, they call it a balut type of thing that pops out of the top of the booster, and as that comes out, that eventually pulls out this large parachute. But this balloon doesn't separate from the parachute. That cable stays attached. So now that the vehicle is coming down on this one big parachute, it's pretty light, by the way. It's only like I think the body of this, you know, the skin of this booster is not even 2 millimeters thick. So it's a pretty light booster. The heavy part, of course, is the engine. That would be at the bottom. And down comes this black electron rocket with the balloon at the top pulling another parachute out. As it's coming through the atmosphere, it gets low enough to where a helicopter is. The helicopter comes flying over. It's got this big hook on the end of it. And grabs the cable that's between this balut and the top of the parachute. Grabs a hold of it and takes the weight little by little and flies it over to a recovery ship. He's got a recovery ship standing by. And the helicopter will bring it down lower and lower and eventually put it on the deck of this recovery ship, and then being able to reuse it. He's happy if he can get like just one reuse out of these things. Peter Beck's talking about, he's not talking about saving money. He doesn't really, he doesn't care, but he will, of course, save money by doing this. 9 engines and a booster itself, it's worth a lot of money. His thing is increasing the cadence of these flights. He can only do like maybe, if he's lucky, 20 flights when he's, when he's really going, maybe in a year or so. He would like to be able to do like 40 flights out of, and this, they launch out of the North Island in New Zealand. He built his own launch facility and everything. So that's where he launches out of. He also wants to launch out of Virginia and Wallops Island, in the United States. He wants to have another launch complex there. In fact, right now he's there. He's got crews building a launch complex for him. Virginia will let him do that. So they'll be flying a lot of rockets out of Virginia. Not too long from now, they'll have the Antares rocket. They've already got the Minotaur rocket, which is another big rocket that's launched by Northrop Grumman, and then they've got they'll have the Electron rocket, and they also have the Scout rockets that I mentioned earlier that launch all the college satellites into suborbital space. Anyway, this is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. If anybody have any comments or questions, I could always go on. Okay, I know I've talked about Dream Chaser before. That's under construction. It also has a $6 billion contract or something. No, not billion. Because it's $2.5 billion. I forgot. A couple of billion-dollar contract with NASA. But it's got a contract for 6 flights, cargo flights, to the International Space Station. Dream Chaser is the one that, looks like a small shuttle. It'll be launched from American soil, and we'll come back and land on the runway. In Florida, we have this 3-mile runway that the shuttle always used to use. And Dream Chaser has now got a deal with NASA to use the new rocket that they're building. They were originally going to send Dream Chaser up on the Atlas V. That was the plan. The new rocket that Boeing and Lockheed are building is called the Vulcan rocket. It doesn't use RP-1 for fuel. The Vulcan rocket uses liquid methane for fuel. They both use liquid oxygen. And they're also not going to use, of course, the existing Russian engines that Atlas V uses. They're going to be using the engines actually built by Blue Origin. Blue Origin is owned by Jeff Bezos, from Amazon fame. And he's, he already built these B-4 engines, they call them, liquid methane, liquid oxygen. They've got the contract with Boeing to actually put these things into the Vulcan rocket. So, Dream Chaser, when it goes up, it's going to be all new. It's going to have a new rocket called the Vulcan. It's going to have new engines, two engines each flight by Blue Origin, B-4, all-American made. And they're going to have the Dream Chaser, which is also built here in the United States by Sierra Nevada Corporation. They've been around for like 30, 40 years launching satellites and stuff into space, and they're the ones building Dream Chaser. They've got these, well, originally it was going to be a crewed vehicle, and they still have plans to do that. They would be able to carry up to 7 people on board the Dream Chaser. But right now, it's just cargo. But it's human rated, of course, because after it's attached to the space station, you're going to have humans go inside and unload and load the this vehicle up. It comes back, lands on a runway, it could bring back scientific equipment, it could bring back Robonauts 2, it could bring back EVA equipment, whatever it is. It's going to be able to bring a lot of weight, too. The most out of everybody would be able to bring up 12,000 pounds. Give you an idea of our Progress Russia vehicle brings up a little over 6,000 pounds. Cygnus brings up 7,700 pounds to the space station. This thing's going to be able to bring up 12,000 pounds. And when it's done, you load it up, it'll deorbit, and we'll be able to land in right back where it came from on the runway in Florida. So, interesting system, the way they have it. You know, it's got the wings, but the wings kind of stick out a little bit, and it really doesn't fit good inside the fairing of either the Vulcan or the Atlas V. So they have it where the wings fold up on the inside. So that means after the launch, the fairing's going to pop off, separate from the vehicle. You know, after the booster separates, and the wings will open up. It'll be able to dock in the space station. When they're opened up, they'll be opened and locked, because on the way back, they're going to need those wings to eventually land back in the United States. Now, before I go on, I was talking about the Electron rocket. I had put a website, you know, a URL for a YouTube onto roy.ac2gs.com website, where you know, you just click on it, and immediately what comes up, it'll say Rocket Lab. And you'll see this whole thing that I described before on how Electron will launch from, you know, in this case, it's launching from New Zealand, North Island, which is what they're doing now. Eventually, we'll launch from Wallops Island, Virginia, as well. But you know how it's going to be able to go up and come down. And they showed this helicopter grabbing this thing out of the sky. It's a very, very good animation. So I think it's worth looking at if anybody's still awake to click on that URL. I think it's pretty amazing what they're doing, especially comparing it to what Elon Musk does. You know, there's a big difference in size. I mean, they all have 9 engines on the bottom and a single engine for the second stage. But you know, Elon Musk is of course much bigger, a couple hundred feet, 230 feet, 229 feet tall. But this thing is, I think, only about like, I don't know, 100 feet tall or something. I think the booster is 60 feet. So, but they're launching different payloads, you know. This thing can launch maybe 1,000 pounds to orbit, where Elon Musk could, you know, probably put up, you know, 30,000 pounds to orbit. A lot more with his Falcon Heavy. So that's the deal on that. Any comments or questions? This is WS2N.
Paul, in that movie that you presented, after this carbon graphite reinforced carbon, I guess it is, rocket and engines, after it does its boosting and the second stage takes off, the first stage comes back down, and it manages to come down in a pure vertical manner for quite a period of time before it deploys the balut or the parachute. And I don't see any paddles at the top. So how does it maintain a vertical descent for that period of time in the beginning? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, I did read that Peter Beck is keeping that secret for now. My guess is he'll probably do something similar to Elon Musk with these fins that pop up at the top. There's a possibility even at the bottom he's going to have some kind of heat shield, an inflatable heat shield. Some people are theorizing, but the word isn't out yet. So you have to assume that right now, to keep it coming straight down, he'll have these nitrogen jets near the top, like Elon Musk does, that will keep it going, until you get into atmosphere. But at some point, he's going to need some kind of, fin type of technology attached to it. He did say to his customers on the next flight or two, don't be alarmed at what you see on the rocket. He's got to figure it out. So he's going to have something on there. We don't know yet, though. Back to you, Dick.
Maybe he's got thrusters that are being used at the top of the bottom before he deploys the paddles. Over to you, Paul.
Well, I know he's got the nitrogen jets, which are essentially small thrusters. I mean, that's what Elon Musk uses to, keep going one way or another. But, to do that all the way down, you would need a lot of gas. Musk uses it to flip the vehicle around 180 degrees to guide it in the beginning, and he also uses the nitrogen thrusters at the very end, right before he either lands on the autonomous ship or he lands on the back of Cape Kennedy or something, because you'll see it. If you look at some of the scenes, you'll see the nitrogen jets going off right at the very end, trying to correct the landing. Make sure it's coming in vertical, and of course the engines are heavily gimbaled. There's no question about that. Back to you, Dick.
Okay, he has made how many launches and how many recoveries do you think he has done, Paul?
When you say he, you're talking about Peter Beck with Rocket Lab?
Roger.
He's had 8 launches so far, all successful. The first one was a test, and that he had problems with one of the range people. They weren't tied in properly on the first flight, so they blew it up intentionally. But after that, he straightened things out. I think he's had 8 successful launches, he hasn't brought anything back yet. His next flight, he's got all kinds of sensing equipment on there, which is going to give him and the engineers all the information that they need, or a lot of the information that they're going to need about thermal conditions, pressures, and everything else as it's coming through the atmosphere. And then from that's how they're going to eventually design this. And he expects to be able to do this by the end of the year, maybe flight 10 or 11 or 12. Back to you, Jeff.
Okay, 8 successful launches implies that he has put 8 customers' worth of hardware into space. The first stage does its boosting and ends up, let me pick a number, 1,000 miles downrange. Gets picked up by a helicopter eventually. And I guess you've got a ship down there, 1,000 miles downrange. At first I was thinking he was going to put the helicopter, fly it all back to the launch site. You wouldn't want to use a helicopter to fly a missile that you're tethering 1,000 miles. So it looks like the majority of the return, he doesn't use rockets to return the 1,000 miles downrange. He's just going to be picking up by helicopter and a ship that's 1,000 miles downrange. That's the impression I'm getting, Paul. Go ahead.
Yes, you can see the ship on a video. It's got a launch, a landing pad for the helicopter. The helicopter's going to take off from that ship and go catch this thing and bring it back to that ship. Launch from New Zealand, the North Island. He launches south. So the ship on the first when I first recovered it is actually going to be located in the Pacific Ocean. He said, you know, that'll be the location of the recovery. When he launches from Wallace Island, that's going to be different. He'll have a ship out in the Atlantic.
Now, what's not clear is how does the helicopter, with its suspension cable, grab onto the cable in between the balloon and the balut? How do you grab onto that cable? That sounds like a delicate maneuver there, Borgad.
Yeah, he's got this cable hanging down, of course, but then he's got, at the bottom of the cable, he's got a, it looks like a weather vane, you know? You know, it's a triangular thing, and it looks like that's keeping the piece stable. Apparently, he used to fly helicopters or something. I remember reading this a while back. He knows about helicopters. In his writings, he says he's not worried about this whole helicopter deal, picking this out of the air. He says this type of thing has been done before. You know, people that fly these helicopters know how to do this, do this type of work. He's more worried about getting this vehicle from eight G's down to, 1 G, the heating and the pressures, and, is that going to be possible? How is he going to get this thing to survive? Back to you, Dick.
Of the 8 successful launches of customers' hardware, how many real recoveries has he done with a helicopter? What's making me ask that question is because the movie he presents is an animation of recovery. If he's really done 8 recoveries, you'd think he would show real movies of the recovery, unless there's something proprietary there. So how many real recoveries with a helicopter do you think he has done, Paul? Go ahead.
None. Zero. He's had 8 successful flights, to orbit. It's a brand new company. In the last couple of years, he's been flying, built his own launch complex, and never had any plans. These were expendable vehicles. They all went into the drink. But now he's changing his mind. So he feels maybe 10, flight 10 or 11 or 12, he'll be able to attempt his first recovery. Yeah, that has not happened yet. Yeah, but it's a good animation of what they're doing, or what he's planning on doing. And it's missing parts. It's missing something he's going to add to this vehicle. Like you said, maybe some kind of aerodynamic something. I'm going to be interested in seeing what he comes up with a couple of flights from now.
So it sounds like each of the 8 successful launches, he considered the booster expendable. I'm wondering if he could have brought it down by parachute, let it fall gently with the parachute into the Pacific or Atlantic, into the ocean, and then recover it. But I guess that recovery is not so good because hitting the ocean does damage, and I guess salt water into the mechanism does damage. That's the reason you don't really want it going into the ocean and recover it from there. Is that true, Paul?
Yeah, that's very true. In fact, they did have that information that he doesn't want water to get near his engines, piping and all of that. The same thing with Dragon. Dragon's now the cargo vehicles. They come back, they land in the Pacific Ocean, and they bring them back on, and there's a lot of work to get that straightened out. They have a new cargo vehicle coming out, very similar to the shape of, a little different shape than the old vehicle. Is very similar to the crew vehicle, what will be going out. Elon Musk has learned a lot about it, and he said that he won't have that many problems with the water on a future flight, on the future cargo vehicles, the water crew vehicles. He's learned a lot about it. He knows how to seal things better and whatever it is. And I'm sure this guy's going to do the same thing. But he doesn't want his rockets to his boosters to touch the water at all, and he'll bring them back to the ship, and that's how they're going to do it. I'm going to say something else about the landing process. Went out of my head. Back to you, Dick.
I've run out of questions. So he wants to make, I think you said, something like 40 launches per year. That's pretty ambitious.
Yeah, and, you know, with once he gets Lobb's Island online, which he thinks by, I read by the end of this year, he hopes to get his first flight in, but I'm going to get, you know, the way things always go, probably the beginning of next year. But between Lobb's Island and most of his flights will take place in New Zealand, he thinks he could, you know, do actually one a week, you know. So it's very ambitious. Another story I've been following, of course, is the Spaceport America down in New Mexico, which was built many years ago. And the idea was to bring in space companies into that area. They have now completed their interior of the building. It looks like a real beautiful interior and the exterior. And the idea of it is to make it look good for the people that will be flying on Unity. Unity is spaceship, what do they call it, Spaceship One by Virgin Galactic. He's almost ready. And the one picture I have is the carrier flight coming in to land at Spaceport America in New Mexico. And that's going to be the headquarters for now. And, you know, if you're going to pay your $200,000, whatever it is, to fly into suborbital space on Richard Branson's rocket, you know, you're going to take off on this carrier plane that's now landed in New Mexico. And eventually that carrier plane is going to go back to California and bring back, Unity. Now, you'll be able to carry like six passengers on this thing, six or eight passengers, and you have a crew of two, pilot, co-pilot, and they expect to start taking customers probably next year sometime. That's my guess. They have a couple more test flights that they need to do before they can put this thing into operation. But the point is, they finished this multi-million-dollar spaceport. I mean, inside, you know, they have downstairs and upstairs, all these lounge chairs and everything for people to look out the window, and I guess visitors to watch you take off and risk your neck on this contraption that Richard Branson has put together. Spaceport America, they call it. Back to you, Jack. Out of time.
Okay, I think you're saying you're through, Paul. Or you're passing it back to me for further questions.
Pretty much, I'm going to watch the EVA next week, and there's always new stories. You know, the Omega rocket that's being built by Northrop Grumman. They've taken over part of the vehicle assembly building down in Florida. We'll probably talk about that as the weeks go on. That's another massive rocket, you know. A lot of stuff going on. I know things are delayed. We talk about these things for years, but little by little they start to come about. I've run out of topics. Back to you, K2RIW. This is WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet.
Very good, Paul. I sure wish James Webb was up there, but I'd rather have them get it right than to lip and then issue it early and make an error, because there is no recovery to James Webb. It's going to no man's land. That Lagrange point, that's a million miles beyond the back of the moon. You ain't going to send any space shuttle, like even if the space shuttle was flying, you're not going to send one of those recovery missions out there to make repairs. Okay, over to Roy if he wants to give us any further. And Roy, you only had two URLs before. I was about to go count your URLs. My goodness, if you've got a lot of them. Wow. AC2GS, K2RIW.
Yes, indeed, Dick. You just need the patience. And I had a lot of stories I ran through, so I had a lot of links to share with people. So I hope they'll click on a few of them, especially the top one, the YouTube of Veritasium. I know you're a fan as well. And it's a delightful exposition on a difficult subject, symmetry, that we touched upon in the past. So anyone who has some free time and likes to see YouTube, that's one of them to catch. And as always, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight and made it the experience that it is. And Dick and Paul giving me this opportunity. And remind everyone once again that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, or if you have any topics you want discussed, or if you have any puzzles you want to share with me, because I could always use them, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And again, the website for the links is roy.ac2gs.com. So until next week, when I'll have a whole bunch of stories and a whole bunch of links, and maybe I'll even think up a puzzler again, 73 to everyone, and I'll be clear.
Thank you, Roy. Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye, you all. See you guys next week. K2RIW.
That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. The time is 12:04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater. Tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30, this is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater.
This is W3VL Mobile.
Welcome to the WA3SFJ repeater. Good morning. The time is 5 o'clock a.m. This is the W2VL repeater. That's tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL repeater. W2VL repeater. Welcome to the WA3SFJ repeater.
KT3VPM Mobile.
Good morning, bad. N3M repeating Mobile.
Hey, good morning, Mark. You have a good weekend.
It's okay, pretty quiet. Not looking forward to these next 2 days, though.
too. Well, we got a lot of heat and rain. I had to look at the weather.
Heat and humidity for next week. Friday looks good.
My wife, man, I was surprised. My wife even said, I'm kind of looking forward to fall. That one shocked me.
Monday morning, super testing.